And hello, everyone, and welcome to Real Conversations in the QC. I'm Redrick Terry. On today's show, we're diving into the experience of being Black in the American education system. It's an experience that has certainly seen its changes over time. Gone are the days of segregated schools and the idea of separate but equal facilities, but this generation of students faces their own unique issues. We're going to explore some of those today from each perspective, from the educators to the students and the people who are working to address those differences in an effort to better prepare children of color for their postgraduate futures. So let's start with some of those issues seen by two people who spent decades helping shape the educational experience for hundreds of Black students here in the Quad Cities. Tim Stinson starts off our conversation today.
Thank you for being here for Real Conversations. Today we are with Dr. Erica Goldstone, former high school administrator as well as middle school administrator. We're going to come back to you, doctor, in a little bit and give us a broad stroke of everything else there before we get into some questions here. And also Mr. James Anderson.
Andrews.
That's right. Mr. James and Andrews, former North High School principal.
Yes.
Okay. So, conversation today and with Real Conversation is what it means to be Black in the American education system. And we have the privilege to have both of you here to dig a little deeper in that because with the schools that you worked with and talk to you a little bit about how you guided what you were able to bring to the school system to help Black students through schooling and things. I want to start with you first, Dr. Goldstone. Give us a little broad stroke of your background, and then we'll get into some more information.
I began in education as a classroom teacher at the high school. Mm-hmm. Later became an administrator at the high school. I have also been a principal at middle school, as central office administrator, as director of equity. In my last position before retiring, I was director of human resources.
Okay. All right. James.
Okay. I've had about every job you can have in education. I was a math and science teacher in Gary, Indiana. That's where, after college, that's where I started. I moved to the high school as a high school counselor, and then I was a dean of students all in Gary. Mm-hmm. And then I moved to the Quad Cities, where I started out as an alternative administrator for the alternative schools, junior high associate principal, high school associate principal, junior high principal, high school principal, associate superintendent on Davenport, moved across the river to Rock Island, Illinois, where I was associate superintendent of HR, mm-hmm. and finished up in 2015, and now I'm volunteering part-time in
All
Rock
right.
Island.
Wonderful. Lot of education is
yes.
sitting here on
that's
this.
That's been pretty much our whole life.
Yeah. Yeah. That's wonderful. That's wonderful. And before I get into some of the questions, I do want to ask, because you started in the educational system, and what kind of roadblocks, if any, that you run into when you first got into this career of education. We'll start with you, doctor.
Well, I think some of those roadblocks are similar roadblocks that others have had. Mm-hmm. Questioning your credentials, questioning whether you are doing what you are supposed to do. And so I think as a person of color, you always have that extra hurdle of proving yourself.
Yes.
You have to be better. You have to work harder. You have to show that you are doing what you're supposed to do. And for me, I really didn't care what other people thought. My role and my goal was to educate students. And for many of those students, it was to convince them that they were worthy, that they could learn, that they could achieve, and then do that. But you knew there was always this other block on your back. Are you supposed to be here?
Okay, I can understand that. Mr. Andrews.
My hurdle began my first year teaching in Gary, Indiana. I taught in the suburbs of Gary. And when I interviewed for the job, it was interesting because my colleagues who also went to a predominantly black college, they came down and recruited Black teachers and they just gave them contracts. When I went to Gary and applied for a job, I had interviews. I had 12 parents, white administrators interview me, and I had to write a essay. Mm-hmm. And so at the end of the interview, they said, you have any questions of us? That's why it's like you're hiring a superintendent and not a teacher, classroom teacher. And they said, how do you feel about going to the suburb? You're going to teach rich white kids. That was my, I said, I teach kids, period. And I did. I taught three African-American kids my first 3 years of teaching, and then the rest is history. But that was the obstacle, just backing up what she just explained. But because of that, it prepared me for the route that I took to get to this point today.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like a struggle. I mean, to be able to stay with it.
Yes.
I mean, and I'm sure there's more, a lot of backstories here that, sure, you know, we can sit here all day and go through all that and stuff.
That's true.
But that's good to hear how you start off. Mr. Andrews, let's start with you and things. Can you share some specific instances where you felt you were the voice and advocate of Black students in your role as a high school principal?
Well, in the Quad Cities, I was the first African-American high school in Davenport, mm-hmm, principal. My kids grew up in the community at North High School, since we're talking about where I was high school principal. Mm-hmm. And I was a role model. I knew that. But we were always on stage in terms of our behavior, our accomplishments, our mistakes, whatever. So I took that to the high school with the young kids. Very high expectations for young people. We had an issue with hiring Black teachers. A lot of Black young teachers just wouldn't come here, or they wouldn't stay. So I think the thing that I noticed was I had openings in other positions, security, paraeducators, mentors. And so I had colleagues and friends, African-American friends, who I convinced to come and work for me. Mm-hmm. And that's how I created my minority role model for my African-American students. They were from the community, and they had degrees, non-degrees, worked at, you know, John Deere. And I realized that they had as much impact as if I had African-American teachers.
Yes.
So I think that's one specific way that I got role models, and I took a different direction with what I had to work with.
Okay. I like that. That sounds good. Dr. Goldstone, as a Black woman in a leadership role, which you've been in, you know, quite a bit here and stuff, within the education system, can you share your perspective, unique challenges faced by Black students and how you address them? And were some of those challenges different if they were male versus female students?
One of the huge challenges, and the data also supports it, for African-American male students, they are the most suspended students in any school district across the country. African-American females are the next high one. The behaviors of students are looked at and are dealt very differently. So one of the things that I was able to work with administrators as the director of equity was to try to balance suspensions. You can never cut them out, but balance. The number one complaint that would come to my office was, if my student is at X school and my student does this, my student gets 5 days suspension. My sister's student is at Y school, does the very same thing, and may get 1 day of suspension. So trying to balance it through that no matter where this student is in elementary, the same offense will get the same thing. Same applies at intermediate, same applies at high school. So at least you're trying to control the number of suspensions. And so that's the outside product.
Mm-hmm.
The inside product is trying to help individual teachers, as well as building administrators, to understand African-American students, number one, Hispanic students, Indigenous students, helping them to understand students of color. They may come to you differently, but if you truly look at them as a student and build a relationship, it will make a huge difference in this child's life.
How, and I hope I didn't cut you off,
no.
But, you know, trying to educate them on that, you know, look at them as a student. Was that hard to do? That were they listening to you and applying it? Was it always a constant struggle?
It's a constant struggle because people come with innate biases. People come with their own perceptions, and you bring those perceptions into your classroom. And the reality of the typical classroom is these students of color are being taught by a white educator who may have had very limited experiences beyond their own community. And now you come into a building and maybe you have a female that is talking to their friend and they're being loud and boisterous. And this teacher is saying, this is a behavior we're not going to tolerate. And all of a sudden, this kid gets into the discipline wheel because this student is only doing what this student does. They are not engaging in a fight. They're not propagating a fight. But if your perceptions are, when I see these behaviors are not, quote, normal, and then you respond inappropriately to those behaviors. So trying to educate people, and I used to always say, and I don't know whether you would remember it, when I would do my equity at schools, I would typically always try to say, would you like to be a member of the H Club? And I would always do it because you kind of get people off and you get their attention. Mm-hmm. And I said, yeah, I want you to join the H Club, the Human Club. And once you join the Human Club, then hopefully you will begin to look at people first and foremost as human beings.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mr. Andrews, touching on this a little bit, you know, with the students, I mean, that we, and I think about when I was coming through school and it was, you know, all white teachers, administrators, you know, et cetera, principals. And how do you deal with the, you know, we're going through a lot as a student. Students are going through a lot. How do you deal with that? What's that conversation look like?
Well, to piggyback on her, first thing I did when I moved to the Quad Cities was to look at the culture, look at the racial makeup. Mm-hmm. Look at the challenges that you have. I remember walking into North High School. I had no black teachers at the time. And I met the staff, and I said, I'm an American who happens to be black, but we are here to educate all the students that walk through the door. And couple of things I did was I made sure that all of the students were represented in any activity that we had at North High School, whether it was show choir, tennis, sports that we normally don't participate in. Mm-hmm. But I also knew the community because by the time I got to North, I'd been through the cross-section of Davenport School District. And so the teachers at that time, we were all about the same age, relatively young, and I introduced them to the black community in a couple of ways. And they wanted to do this because they wanted to be better. They recognized the fact that they hadn't dealt with minority students in teaching. So I convinced them, and we attended black churches. On Fridays, I took a whole host of them to black clubs in mm-hmm. Rock Island. And at those black clubs were parents of our students, black parents, grandparents. And it worked both ways because the black parents said, they came to us. They came over here when that was a no-no.
Right.
They were with me. Nothing was going to happen. Once they started to feel comfortable, we started to get black parents to come to school, and they helped us with the discipline And they felt more comfortable because my teachers came to them. Mm-hmm. And that was major for me in terms of community involvement, relationship building. And I also, for job market, I had African-Americans who worked at John Deere, who I got to come in and do training with my teachers so they could see what kind of jobs were available if you didn't get a college degree.
Okay.
So those kind of things.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Where we're at now, you know, 2024, and we have, you know, young Black students of color getting ready to graduate and getting ready to go to universities. Maybe there's students that have been into either number one, an all Black kind of high school, more predominantly Black or people of color, or they are in a school that is predominantly white. How do principals, administrators, teachers, educators get those Black students ready to move on to the next level that they might be the only Black person on campus?
Can I kind of roll back a little?
Please.
At the time of graduation, you're running kind of out of time. Mm-hmm. And now you, a student, may have to do other options. These things have to start earlier than by the time you are a junior or senior. Even when I was a middle school principal, I was out in the halls all the time. When it was passing time, I was out in the halls. I was constantly in and out of classrooms. Hey, I love that tie you have on. You try to build relationships through authentic conversations with students. Once you have begun building a relationship, now you begin to, hey, what are you going to do? You know, before you know it, you're going to be a senior. What are you going to do? And so even in that middle school, you're trying to propel kids onto the right roads.
Mm-hmm.
Let me give you an example. Many students in middle school, there was a time you could take a general math course or you could take Algebra 1 at the high school. So what would students do? They would opt to take the general math course. That general math course is not going to get you into college. So you have to begin to program students at middle school to begin thinking about and having conversations with parents as well. You've got to pick the right courses as you're going into high school if you are thinking about going to college. Now, for me, the most difficult conversation with a student of color who was an athlete, they are looking at the professional ranks. I'm going to be the next Michael Jordan. I'm going to be the next Caitlin Clark. Well, the reality is many high school students may get some college experience, but those numbers continually drop that your chances of getting into professional athletics is very limited. And so I always try to say to our students, you know, it's called student athlete. You are a student first and foremost, mm-hmm. and then athletics. And so part of this is building your future, that if on the first day of your professional athletic career, you damage something, you now have an academic background to fall on. But you start those conversations very early. And as an intermediate principal, I felt compelled because I had been at the high school and I knew the paths that some students take and it's not going to get them where they want to be. And so you start those conversations very early, just as I'm sure my colleague would start them when they hit ninth grade, and really getting these kids prepared that once you are a junior or senior, now you're going off into the direction you want, whether it is a college or university, or whether it is into a career technical field.
No, pretty much.
All right, let's continue the conversation now with the efforts being seen within two of our area's biggest school districts. We're talking Davenport and Rock Island. Jasmine Butler spoke to the people behind groups that are dedicating time to help them adjust, learn, and grow.
All right, today I have Dr. Yolanda Granberry-Pugh from Rock Island, Ruben Moore with Davenport Community School District, and Kim Riley Quinn here with us today. And we're going to be talking about some of your guys' organizations that you guys currently have and then that you guys had and how that impacted the Black students. So let's dive. Let's chat about the programs that you have had that centered around Black students in your building.
Sure. So at Rock Island High School, I am the co-sponsor of the African American Heritage Club. My other co-sponsor is Dr. LaShante Williams. The club has been in existence since 2007. At moments in times, because people were in school or, you know, working on another career ambition, it kind of died down, but then we picked it back up. So currently it's been running smoothly for the last 5 years at the high school. We do center around, our club centers around African-American culture, the positive aspects of African-American culture. So all of our inventors, our doctors, our lawyers, those who have helped weave the fabric of America, mm-hmm. including our food and our clothes and our music as well.
Yes. Love it. All right. And Kevin Rubin.
Well, I'm 25 years with QC United.
Yes.
And we, My job when I first started was to get to school, probably take minority kids out to see things. But then I include everybody into it because every kid should see something. I mean, you learn more when you leave your environment. So one of the things I wanted to do was get them out of their environment into another environment so they can handle themselves. So we took a lot of trips in New York City and Disney World and Washington, D.C., but they were all learning trips. It wasn't just for you to go have fun. You had to learn something while you was there. I put a golf tournament on just so I could raise money to help them go to college. So every year for the last 25 years, I've been giving scholarships away in June. So that's one of the things I like to do, and that's one of the things I always done. So.
Yeah, love it. And Kim?
So, well, I've been around a while now. So we used to do a program at North High School. Well, actually, it was throughout the Quad Cities, called Quad City Scholars, and I directed that for about 7 years. And that started before I, you know, got involved with it. And it originally started with a lot of support from John Deere and Alcoa. And so we had programs in North, West, Central, and Davenport, and we had a program at Rocky, UT, and Moline. Mm-hmm. So it was a great opportunity for students from all over the Quad Cities to get together for some programming. It did focus a lot on Black students. We had a variety of students that participated, but the focus was always on going to college and preparing for that, thinking big, you know, like outside of the Quad Cities, you know, what do you see yourself doing, or what can you imagine yourself doing? And then we would try to have different opportunities for them throughout the school year that supported all kinds of ideas. Yeah. College campus visits, bringing speakers in. We did some fun things too. It was really important to have give back.
So what impact has it had on your students?
I believe the African American Heritage Club has had an extremely positive influence on the students at Rock Island High School, solely because it is a safe zone for them to explore their culture, but also providing opportunities for other students to explore their culture as well. The students that are in our club are actually a combination of students who are direct descendants of Africa and then African American students as well. So it's a nice little blend, especially like at the end of the school year when we have our potluck and all of them bring dishes from home, because you get to try a variety of foods from various cultures, even though everybody in the room is brown. Mm-hmm. And then also we do go on college trips. We specifically take them to HBCUs when we travel outside of Illinois, but then we also make sure that we take them to Augustana and Western as well. And we will make our way over to St. Ambrose. We will get there. Overall, the kids keep coming back. We keep getting more and more students. One young lady that worked with us 1 year ended up getting a full ride to a university at HBCU simply because we went and visited and ended up having a nice conversation with some of the people that were in charge there. So overall, I would say a very positive experience. And yesterday, we hosted our third Black History program at Rock Island High School. So the kids got to explore our music, starting from spirituals all the way to the music today. I didn't get to be in the audience because I was in the back controlling everything, but I heard a lot of people did a lot of dancing. So yes. As far as I know, they had an awesome time.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And I wish I would have known before because I would have loved to see that. That is great that you guys are doing that. That, you know, because a lot of people, they just think that, you know, there's only a certain type of music. And the fact that we're like, no, you know, Black people, we created a lot of different music. Like, very, yes, I love that.
Thank you.
Good job.
Thank you.
Ruben.
Yes.
QC United, how has it impacted the community?
Well, the kids have gotten, we know for a fact that 70% of our kids graduated from college. I stick with most of them I still know. That's one of them sitting up on the stand with us right now. The impact on the community is a lot of them stay here, and we need them to stay here to help the community. So that's one of the things I was focused on when I was doing it. Go to college here, stay here, come up with jobs and come up with businesses and be on the police department because a lot of my students are in the fire department and just become part of the Quad City because that's where they grew up in. And the other part was to get them to leave town so they could see how it was. I was surprised how many kids were scared to get on an airplane. You know, The first time I took some kids on an airplane, I had a young lady was crying, and of course everybody said I had to say something to her, and I go, she all right. And they said, you gotta say something to her. So I walked over and I, what's the problem? She said her uncle had told her the plane was going to crash. Mm-hmm. And I said, how did he know? He been on a plane? She said, no. You sit next to me on a plane. He's never been on a plane, so how he knew it was going to crash or not? So we went to Disney World, and watching them get off the plane in Atlanta and following the rules, because they don't know what's going on. Yeah. Take your shoes off, put your shoes on. And as we got to Atlanta, one of my kids got on the train, and you know how fast people are at the airport. They're in a hurry, you know.
Especially in Atlanta. You know, yeah.
So we're on the train, waiting for the train to go to the next course. And the door was closing, and the young man was taking his finger doing like this. And the door would open back up. Well, you know, people getting upset. And I'm trying to figure out what's wrong with that door, because I'm standing behind him. And I just happened to look over, and there he was. Every time the door got closed, he thought it was funny. He'd take his finger going like this. You're going to get hurt here. I put him away from the door, you know what I mean? But they, on the way back, they spent 4 days in Disney World, they saw everything. I made sure, I wanted to go to the Epcot Center because I think it's one of the most important things that Disney has. Because you can see all nationalities, the food, you can see all kind of dances and music and the whole nine yards when you go to the Epcot Center. Mm-hmm. On the way back, they were like professionals. Mm-hmm. Did Mr. Wotay take his shoes off? You got to take your shoes off right here. And I'm going, okay.
they knew.
They knew what to do. You know what I mean? So I've enjoyed doing it. I've been doing it so long now. I just like have it with me, you know. Yeah. But I think it's for the young people to see places to go, meet people outside their area, because we get too comfortable in our area. Because you know, I grew up in Chicago, but I've been all over the place. You know, so you get to know people, see people, and learn things. Mm-hmm. And I've been pretty happy with that.
Yeah, I know. Since I am a part of QC United, and those dream come true trips are, oh my gosh, just breathtaking. Seeing those kids, you know, experience something that they may not have the opportunity to experience in their lifetime. I remember when we took the kids to New York and were able to go see this. Well, we weren't really able to see the Statue of Liberty, but, you know, getting close to it and then seeing the 9/11 exhibit that they had there was just amazing. And then, you know, even when we went to Chicago, a lot of kids who have relocated to the Quad Cities from Chicago, they've never been to Navy Pier before. Huh. You know, we were able to take them to an amusement park that
It was
a lot of different things.
The museum.
New York City was kind of a special thing for that. We had a really, really good guide. Mm-hmm. And she kept us moving. But she did. But we saw, that wasn't too much we didn't see in New York City. I mean, the kids, some of the kids have been back since then. And I've seen some of them, and they go, they're grown now. And they go, hey, Mr. Moore, I couldn't wait to go back to New York City again. I go, yeah. You know, I thought the fun part of New York City was going to Harlem.
That was my favorite part. Yeah, you took the words right out of my mouth, Ruben.
They had that special little deal where you go buy stuff, and the guy was showing you guys how to go in and kind of. The guy said it was $29. They showed you how to say, well, I don't have 29, but I have 19. You know, and then when we got ready to leave. You remember that when they took the picture of all of us and put it on the wall?
No, I don't remember that. Yeah,
they put us on. they took all the pictures of all the kids and they put them on. It was on the wall. Oh. So some guys from here with the New York City, they were walking through Harlem, and they seen that picture. And the guy said, "Hey, that's Ruben's kids. There he is, right there."
Really?
You know, yeah.
They put it's with, a small
world. In that little mall we went to?
I remember going to the mall because there were so many things that I wanted to buy there. Mm-hmm. Like, it was just so many different cultures and just so much stuff. Yeah. I've never seen anything like that before.
And she would taught you guys how to barter, so you guys thought that was cool.
Yes.
Can I get that for 10? No, you cannot get it for 10. Go up a little bit.
You know?
Always try. Yeah,
it's okay.
But it was a lot of fun watching them learn about Harlem and all the different places we went, all the things we saw. It was cool.
Yeah, I was thinking about relocating to Harlem after that. That's how much education we had when we went there. I'm like, Harlem is the place for me. Like the restaurant that we went to go just everything was amazing. Yeah.
So did you guys like talk about the Harlem Renaissance before you went?
No.
No, we just went.
No, I mean, that is the English teacher in me.
But we made them take pictures and stuff.
Yes. Yeah.
We made them write stories. Mm-hmm. We made them, I think the craziest thing that we did when we came back was when we dropped the kids off in Rock Island. Mm-hmm. All the parents, as we got off the bus, and I'm off, they go, well, man, we had a lot of fun in New York. And I go, if you went on the bus, they were sending pictures back of everything they did. Everything they'd done in New York City, the parents had. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the parents were getting on, we got on the bus, the parents going, we had a lot of fun in New York, didn't we? I said, yeah, I guess we did. And then the kids say, Mr. Moore, we sent them the pictures. I said, okay. But we went everywhere. I mean, we stayed in great hotels. We didn't stay in any, I wanted to make sure the kids had the same feeling as if their uncle was rich. So they stayed in really nice hotels. They had really good food.
Yeah.
They had a ball. And they still, I still see them, they still... the young lady who was Miss Iowa, she was on that trip with us.
Was she? I didn't realize she was. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She became Miss Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
She was Rocky High School, and then she became Miss Iowa a couple of years after we got back.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I still talk to her. All, mm-hmm. I do. You know, I still like doing it. I'm still doing it now. I'm helping other guys. I'm helping guys with the HBCU schools too.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was very impactful. Like I said, New York was really the title, The Dreams Come True. Like, it was a dream come true trip. That was amazing.
That's great.
What pullback did you have in starting your organizations?
I don't think there was pullback per se. I went to all of the teachers who were in the building at the time in 2007 who were African-American themselves. And asked them to help me, like, write a proposal and present it to the principal and present it to the school board. So the original proposal, which I still has everyone's name on it still. So in actuality, the club belonged to all of the African-American teachers who were in the building at the time. But they've either left Rocky or they're retiring this year. I need to say names, but I'm afraid I'm going to forget some names. But Mrs. Jennifer Page Pearson, she's still at Rocky. She was one of the original co-founders with me. Vanessa Taylor was one of the original co-founders with me. Tia Edwards, at the time, who was Tia Rice, she was one of the original founders. And I know I'm forgetting somebody, and that's why I didn't want to say names. But whoever was in the building in 2007, they all signed it. So it was a, a cohort of the African-American teachers who felt like it was something really needed in the building. And then at that time, Dr. Anderson was the principal, who happened to be African-American as well. And so I think at that moment in time, we were all in agreement that that was something that our students needed in the building. Mm-hmm. And so we made it happen.
Yeah, good job. Yes. Thank you. Good job. Ruben, what pullback have you had with QC United in the early beginning stages? I know it's gone on to be very, very successful now, but in those beginning stages, what pullback did you have?
Well, when I started the golf tournament, the pullback was I didn't play golf. So everybody go, it's not going to work. You know? So it'll work. You know? So one of the things I liked about it was I didn't play golf, and it was right. But I figured, get a bunch of my friends together. They played golf, mm-hmm. You know. Guys I knew, there were teachers that I knew who I played golf. I'd go ask them questions. And before you know it, they'd show me how to put it together. And a couple of my good friends helped me start it. I had some sponsors came along and said, okay, you know, what you doing? I said, I'm trying to educate kids. And, you know, okay, if you're doing it, we know you. Let's do it. So it was a combination of a group of people that came and helped me out. I'll mention two names because I can't forget two names. I mean, Bill Jetters was one of them. And I knew him. I had known him for years. He said, what you need? And I told him, he go, I got it. And then Scott Reynolds from Reynolds Ford was the other one. I told him I need him to do some things and I need him to put a car out there. It's okay. Now, most tournaments didn't have cars. You know, I had a small tournament when I first started, but it was fairly big because I had guys coming from Michigan and Mississippi and Des Moines and Waterloo to play in a tournament for the guy who don't know nothing about golf. Yeah. You know what I mean? So here we are 25 years later.
Yeah.
And we still come in here to business to play golf and we're still raising money for kids and we bring the kids there so the kids can talk to the guys when so they know who they're playing golf for, mm-hmm. and they love it. They come every year. New guys are coming in every year. Next year they want to make it really big because it's 25th anniversary. So they want to put a dinner on and they want to. I got some commitment from some people. I won't say who they are, pro football players that I know. Some of my students. You know what I mean? I find that most of my students coming to help me whatever anything I do, you know what I mean. So and I take that to heart because, when I was at North High School, I wanted to make sure, and when I'm at West, the same thing, and I haven't changed my style in either one of them. I wanted to make sure they felt safe, and every one of them said we felt safe with you, Brian. You know, and I take that to heart because that's what I want. I want to feel safe. I want to understand. They can come talk to me about anything. They're looking for a job. When I first got there, me and Mr. Andrew, we'd go find them jobs, you know what I mean? Whatever we need to do to get them to the next step, mm-hmm. You know? So I took pleasure in that. So, but I didn't have too many pullbacks that I couldn't play in. Yeah. Everybody teased me on that one. They still tease me on that one. Still can't play golf.
That's okay with it. And Kim, what about you with QC Scholars? What pullback did you have in the early beginning stages?
So we had good support from the school principal, but he was African American, so mm-hmm. he was all for it, and he was always really good about trying to do some innovative things in the building to get kids more involved. Some of the pullback, I think, more was some staff because we didn't expect all of our students to be 4.0 students. We did expect them, you know, to work hard and to stay out of trouble. I mean, those were our basic roles, mm-hmm. come to school. Mm-hmm. But so sometimes I would get some pullback, like, well, why are you letting him or her go on that field trip? Mm-hmm. You know, like, they should stay back and do this or that. And I did always expect the students to, you know, do the work, you know, if they missed something to make it up. But sometimes I don't think people understood the value of going on these field trips, you know, and what they learned. You know, we learn beyond just a classroom. And, you know, being able to interact with other professionals in the community because, you know, we did a lot of that. We would, and, well, we got great participation from different professionals, you know, in the community. They like to come and talk to students and tell them about their careers and, you know, the options that are available and that sort of thing. And, you know, you don't get that necessarily sitting in a classroom. Mm-hmm. And they go hand in hand, you know. So I did sometimes hear about that, you know, but they got over it. We went on.
Very good. So, Kim, why do you think QC Scholars is not around anymore? What would be your thought process on the whys?
So part of it is, so most of these programs, and I'm not sure about yours, but most of these programs depend on grants and, you know, different kinds of funding like that. So it's not guaranteed. Mm-hmm. And so funders, you know, they change their interests. And so it started to be much more about, like, STEM programs, which are great and important, and I wouldn't want to take anything away from them. But that took dollars away from our program, but not just STEM, but others. And, you know, so the interest switched, the funders started focusing on different things, you know, and we just didn't have funding anymore. Some of the board members, you know, just weren't around anymore. And, you know, we didn't have the voices we needed to support the program. So it kind of just went away.
Mm-hmm. So how did your program impact the community? We talked about the students, but how does it impact the community?
Our program, it encourages the parents in the community to get involved. So it's not just for the students, it's for the students' parents as well. And so over the years, we have had parents come on in and help us out with different things, from our programs to group discussions. Right now, we got two parents that are interested in going on our field trip with us, which someone told me to stop calling it a field trip. It's not a field trip. It is a multi-educational experience, because we will be going to Nashville. We'll visit Fisk, TSU, and Meharry, but we'll also go to the National Museum of African American Music. I believe that is the correct name. But either way, so when the parents come, then that information automatically makes its way back out into the community because the parents talk amongst themselves. We've also done community service over the years, as well, from doing the King Center's Thanksgiving dinner, where you go down and you help serve plates down there. So we've done that over the years. What else have we done in the community? One year we went and planted flowers in an elderly lady's yard because she couldn't do it herself, but she wanted some flowers in her yard, so we did that one year. Most of our activities are inside of the school, and they are specifically for the students who are inside of the school, mm-hmm. but every once in a while we will branch out into the community.
I love your first statement when we were talking about the two parents. I love that the students are learning something and they're taking it back home and having these conversations. And so it's like you're educating the students, but you're also educating their family, who's educating the community, which mm-hmm. is education. You can't go wrong with it. Mm-hmm. So that's so beautiful. Yes.
Yeah. I'm the first in my family to graduate from a 4-year university. It was something that was always talked about in our household, but my older brother went to the military, and then my younger brother and my younger sister, I think my young brother has an associate's degree. My sister went to cosmetology school. But as far as like that actual authentic 4-year university experience, I'm the only one that can attest to that. Gotcha. And so, yeah, it makes a difference.
It does. Yeah. Yes. Ruben, how has QC United impacted the community?
Well, one of the things is they know who I am now. They know who my kids are. At the end of every golf tournament, my students have to get in front of all the golfers and explain what school they're going to be going to, what they're going to try to be. I mean, some be a police officer, but you know, wind up being a fireman, you know what I mean? But they get a chance to tell all the golfers. So the golfers sit there and get to see all this, which I think is an impact to golfers, too, because they like the idea we're helping kids, you know, and we can see the kids that we're helping. As far as the community concerned, I have so many programs going. I got Pete the Purple Bull for Pete's Sake, Don't Bully. Me and Ms. Quinn got all kind of programs going on. I can't keep up with all of them. I mean, I just did the HBCU school, the first time the HBCU band been in the Quad City, in Iowa, not in Quad City, in the whole state of Iowa. It was here in October, and I made that happen for the Delaware School Committee. They wanted me to see if I could bring one, and I brought one, and now Rock Island wants to see if I can bring another one. So I'm all over the community. I mean, I think the Rock Island Elks for helping me start the golf tournament, because between them and Jed and those guys, wouldn't have been no golf tournament. We've given over $200-some thousand in scholarships, but a small program with 3 or 4 people. I mean, we don't have a lot of people. I mean, so I do have a lot of people when the showtime show up, and most of them are my past students. So it's been I think the community that knows me. And knows QC United knows what we're all about. You know what I mean?
Now to a special luncheon for students in the Quad Cities area that is sitting them face-to-face with people who may be their future employers one day. We're talking about the Embrace Race Luncheon, an event that provides a space for area CEOs and business leaders to speak directly to students. We are talking Embrace Race, and two of the main drivers behind that initiative are joining us now in Real Conversations, the CEO of Estes Construction, Kent Pilcher, as well as Tracy Singleton, the executive director at the Lincoln Center. Thank you both for being here today.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And so let's talk about this, because this is a very interesting concept. The Embrace Race Luncheon, how did that idea become a reality?
Well, I met Kent prior to the first Embrace Race at a big table conversation as an initiative with the chamber. And so I was invited to speak at an event not too long after I met him. And as I was sitting on the stage, we were talking about different mentoring programs because they were talking about job retention in the Quad Cities. That was the topic. And as I looked out into the audience, I noticed it was 72 older white men. And it was a CEO's breakfast. And so as I was sitting on the stage, I wasn't intimidated because I've had to be in these spaces. But I started thinking about the boys of Well-Suited. And I was like, gosh, they would probably be really intimidated in a room like this. Mm-hmm. And although it's very important for me that they see men who look like them, because they don't see that on a day-to-day basis, I also had to understand the reality of where we live. And we only make up 11% of the population here in the Quad Cities. So I knew there were going to be times when they would be in rooms, at tables, in businesses where they may be the only Black person in that space. So it was important that they get comfortable talking with everyone. So I called Kent. And I said, hey, Kent, can you invite some of your friends over? You know, like, can we have a breakfast or something where the boys can meet these CEOs and presidents and business owners? And Kent actually is like, that's a great idea. You actually help us, you know? And so that's how Embrace Race was born.
Yeah. And Kent, from your perspective, when Tracy came to you with this idea, what was going through your mind in terms of why you decided to take part in this?
Well, as you know, Tracy is a force of will. So, and I've seen her do other things in the community. So when she puts her will to it, it happens, and it usually happens in a very successful way. So I knew Tracy not real well, but well enough to know that was her reputation. And more importantly, the premise for this was twofold. She's explained the first, but the second one what really resonated with me, which Embrace Race comes from. And the way Tracy said this was, look, we have a lot more things in common than we have apart, but the national narrative doesn't quite sound like that today. And I thought, what a great opportunity to do two things. One of them, embrace that narrative that we have a lot more in common. And one of the things our company focuses on with a lot of its philanthropic work is disadvantaged or at-risk youth anyhow. So it was in a sector where we put a lot of investment and have a lot of energy. And then the idea, you know, what she does with Well Suited, and then this is a nice contrasting bookend with Embrace Race and getting CEOs to the table. And it's been incredible how well embraced it's been in the CEO and business community.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, from both of your perspectives, what has this been like so far, this journey that really hasn't been done before here in this Quad Cities area? How's the experience been so far?
I will say that it does grow each year. We get more and more people at the table, no pun intended, but we do. So it's growing. And I think the awareness, you know, you have events for a few reasons. Either it's an awareness event or it's to raise money. Embrace Race, it's more of an awareness event, and putting these boys at the tables with people who could be their future employers. And so for me, on my end of it, to see those conversations, to see the boys become comfortable, and you got some that you'll never hear say a word, but then when you leave, they're asking questions, they're taking business cards, they're developing that relationship. And for me, that's what it's for. Most of these boys are in junior high, high school, so they're not quite into the workforce yet. But to establish those relationships early, and to have them comfortable having those conversations, to me, that's what I'm seeing the most benefit of it.
Yeah. And Kim, from your perspective, what are you noticing in terms of the people that are taking part in this, how they feel about it, how it's been responded to so far?
Well, the recognition has been great. I mean, the response of people getting it gets larger every year. And more importantly, the comments you hear afterwards from the CEOs that attend about how worthwhile and unique this has been for them. And they're getting more out of this. I think they're getting certainly as much as some of the young men are, but they're getting a lot out of this too. And realizing two things. One, that it's a community they're normally not exposed to. And many of these young men are not, you know, they're from tough backgrounds, many of them are. And so the second thing is, if we can send the simple message to them that you care in our community, we care in our, about you and our community, I should say, and we want you to be successful. Again, that's not a narrative they hear very often, other than from people like Tracy and organizations like this. And so for me, that's very rewarding, and I think it's very rewarding for other CEOs.
I like what you said as we go back a little bit. You know, we have a lot more in common than we might think before. Why do you think it's so important for initiatives like this to kind of hammer home that and figure out, you know, exactly what some of those commonalities are among our various groups here in the Quad Cities?
Well, you know, again, the national narrative is not just about race, but about anything is how different we are. Well, that's just that's a narrative that's not going to serve us well long term. But in particular with race, there are so many experiences I had as I grew up, as I went to college and athletics, that exposed me to things that changed my outlook. And if we can keep people's minds somewhat open, or even a lot open, about maybe what we have in common, the better off we'll all be. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, we know the world is changing very dynamically. And I think if, for at least for the business community, if we're going to be successful, we have to think differently than we have in the past. And you're seeing a fair amount of that. But how do we embrace that, to use the same term? How do we embrace that? And how do we really look at our communities? Because the most successful communities are the ones that are the most diverse. And not only the most diverse, but they have the fastest growing GDP, gross domestic product. And so it makes good business sense to do this too. And if we can help these young men who are, you know, let them know someone cares about them and keep them engaged in school and committed, and let them get out and build a life rather than maybe take some other alternative, it's good for the community.
Absolutely. Mutually beneficial, no doubt about it. Now, Tracy, we're talking about those young men. You said it, these are junior high schoolers. They're not quite in the workforce yet, but it could maybe even be a little bit difficult to put them at that table and have them speak with people who are different from them. What's that been like? Is that a challenge? And how do you get over that challenge in order for them to get everything that they can get out of this program?
I think the first couple of years, it was a challenge because, you know, teenagers, they don't talk, right? They don't talk. And so the past couple of years, I've really worked with the different coordinators of the programs of the boys that we invite to kind of prepare them and let them know, hey, this is who's going to be at the table. These are the type of things that you discuss. And I will say initially the first year I was going to put questions in a fishbowl, but I'm going to let these people know how bad these boys have it being Black in America. And then I had to change my mindset to, wait, no, we need to talk about what makes us come together. What do we have in common versus how are we all so different? And so those were the questions that were put in the fishbowl. And it was simple as, what's your favorite ice cream? What's your favorite baseball team? What's your favorite hobby? And then they start talking and realizing, wait a minute, that's mine too. And those how those conversations start. And so we do have some boys that have come every year. based on they were in junior high when it first started, and now they're in high school, so they kind of know what to expect. But I do give a lot of credit to the coordinators of the different mentoring programs because they do prepare the boys for this. But I also feel like we set the tone as soon as they come in the room. It's very inviting. Everyone's up shaking hands and introducing themselves. Our speakers have been wonderful the past couple of years talking about the importance of this. We've also brought in boys who have changed, who's been impacted by Embrace Race, whether it's through connections or funding. So I think it's to the point now, this is our fifth year, which I'm really excited about, but I think it's to the point now where people understand what the expectations are, and they're actually looking forward to it.
Yeah. And you mentioned some of those people though, who have been positively affected by this initiative. Talk about some of those people. What are some of the successes that have come from this?
You know, I will say last year, this is probably the one that has been most impactful to me. There was a young man who I had seen, but I didn't know, who attended Rocky. And he was interviewed by the news. That was the first time he was ever interviewed. In his interview, which I saw later on that evening, he talked about, I want to be here because I need to meet these people. I want to be successful. I want to make my mom proud. And then they did a backstory on his mom who suffered a very violent death from a ex-boyfriend. And I was like, oh my gosh, like this kid, I want to help him, you know? And so I knew where he worked and I called. I said, hey, if he ever mentions anything he needs, you let me know. And I'm going to do whatever I can to help him. And then I met him a couple days later and I told him the same thing. And I'll tell you to this day, he says that this program, that event is what put him on the path to success. He's in college. He's worked internships. He wants to be a sports agent. So he's staying within that realm. But more importantly, he's in college and he's staying dedicated to that. And the funds that we raised, we were able to help him buy a car, you know, and so that he could get back and forth to school with no issues. So that's what these things are for. But when I have kids stop me and they're like, oh, hey, you know, I went to your event or I kept that card and I asked those questions or when is it coming up again? I know we're on the right track, you know, for doing what we need to do. It's very hard to just be a teenager, period.
Yeah.
It's very hard when you're in a environment that might not always be conducive to success. So when you know that there's a community of people who truly care, who truly want you to succeed, it just makes it that much easier to do what you want to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And Kent, when you hear about some of those stories, the real impact that this has had on many of the kids who have taken part, how does that make you feel knowing how this started and what it's become?
Well, you know, when you think about just the ability to pack one life like Tracy's story, much less, we're pretty confident it's changing perspectives of CEOs and the young men both. Because I've heard a lot of those comments come back from the CEOs as well.
I feel like the biggest benefit is that I'm able to see students that look like me.
Inside Rock Island High School is a unique club, the African American Heritage Club.
We talk about the different stuff that happened in our community, the controversy that we have within the school, or in general, what's happening in real life.
Around since 2007, the club meets weekly and has had over 100 total students, providing an open space for important dialogue about a variety of topics.
Racial issues, social issues, just so many issues that we have today that I feel like have to be spoken about. Having those experiences and being able to talk about them and just like the trauma and all so many other stuff that you deal with as a Black person has to be spoken about.
In some Quad Cities classrooms though, there aren't many African American students. It's an experience Assumption freshman Orion Rowe knows.
They expect a lot out of you when you're the only, like, when it's only a little bit of you there. So you have to, like, you have to show out, you have to stand out, you have to be great, you have to be perfect at all times. Like, you have to be 100%.
And while Rose says he doesn't feel pressure, he wants to set a positive example for African-American students that follow in his footsteps.
Because once you like, bring yourself down, like, they look at you differently than others. So even if somebody were to do something, the exact same thing you did, it wouldn't be the same.
For Real Conversations, I'm Evan Denton.
So there's a lot of content that we weren't able to fit into today's episode. You can check out our website, kwqc.com, and click on the Real Conversations tab for more. And before we go today, we'll remind you that this show is brought to you in part by Together Making a Better Community at the Lincoln Center in Davenport. TMBC is the hub for African-American programs, services, and support in the Quad Cities. For more information on the several events happening there, you can check out their Facebook page. It's TMBC at the Lincoln Center. And that's all the time we have for today's show. For all of us here at Real Conversations, thanks so much for being with us, and we hope to see you next time.